part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Learn about Krannert Center's 2006-2007 performance season, including family performances of Ralph's World, the ballet Cinderella, and the Drummers of Burundi, by visiting KrannertCenter.com or browsing a season brochure.
During this hour, Focus 580 will present an archive interview that originally aired on September 19th, 2004. As this is a repeat performance, so to speak, we can't take your calls during this hour. Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, your host. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of the show, we are joined by Reverend Susan Thistlethwaite. She is the director of the Chicago Theological Seminary. She is going to talk about Christian conflict resolution, and the title of her talk, Differing Without Demonizing. And certainly these days, there are a number of things that conflict resolution might well be applied to. We're engaged in a great deal of conflict around the world, and it seems to involve very deeply held convictions, many of them religious convictions. We'll talk about some of her thoughts on these subjects during this hour. Reverend Thistlethwaite has been at the Chicago Theological Seminary for some time. Before becoming the director there, she was a professor of theology for 16 years, and she directed the PhD center there for 5 years. She has a PhD from Duke University and a divinity degree, also from Duke, and she's an ordained minister at the United Church of Christ since 1974, is the author of 10 books, and has written widely on a number of issues, including many op-ed pieces in the Chicago Tribune, among other places. And we're glad to have her with us. And thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome, Jack. I'm glad to do it.
Just to begin, do you want to say something about the Chicago Theological Seminary for people who don't know about it?
Certainly. We are the oldest institution of higher learning in the city of Chicago. And we were founded 150 years ago. We're actually celebrating our sesquicentennial. And everyone has had to learn to say sesquicentennial. This, having practiced Thistlethwaite, is not as difficult as it might be at some other institutions. And we have, we joke that say that we are on the campus of the University of Chicago, but our real location is at the corner of church and society. And for 150 years, we're very much formed in the social gospel movement, have always been directed towards peace and justice issues. And as we've been studying the history of the seminary, which is what one does when you celebrate the 150th year, there's a surprising degree of coherence. Someone who graduated in 1902 is recognizable as a graduate of Chicago Theological Seminary for that focus on where church and society cross.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. Let's talk a little bit about Christian conflict resolution. It's certainly, as I perhaps alluded to in the introduction, maybe very much in need.
Yes, yes, I would certainly agree with you. I would say in introducing the topic that as you study the guidelines of Christian conflict resolution that today we could not systematically be violating these guidelines any more, I think, than we are. And I can go into that with you in more detail in a few minutes, mm-hmm. especially if your listeners are interested and have questions about it. I'm going to talk about a larger movement called Just Peacemaking. And there is, if you study the history of Christian thought, Christians have had three fixed ways that they have approached war and peace. And the first would be pacifism. Christians were basically pacifist for the first three centuries. It was actually, you could be thrown out of the church for heresy in the first three centuries of the church if you joined the military. After the Peace of Constantine, when Christianity became the official religion of the empire, you have the development of just war theory. And I wrote an editorial in the Chicago Tribune about just war theory. It's not unuseful in thinking about, for example, preemptive war. Preemptive war violates the tenets of just war theory. And the third is crusade. And Christians participated vigorously in the Crusades in the High Middle Ages. And those have been the three. And so there are a movement of people, it's been going on for a couple of decades now, that are trying to find a fourth paradigm, which we call just peace. And this is heavily influenced by the work of Dr. Martin Luther King, trying to combine conflict resolution with nonviolent direct action. and a host of activities that are dedicated, as is pacifism, to bringing about an end to violence, with the kinds of emphases on justice making that were so much a part of the work and teaching of Dr. King, as well as Gandhi, and now we have models from South Africa, and so that around the world, there are newer movements that are giving us a lot of encouragement, frankly, that just peacemaking is possible.
It's interesting to note about the current war on terror, as we have termed it. We often say that it is not about religion. It is not a clash of religions. Although religion is very much a part of the conflict. I mean, it's part of the people's lives who are engaged in the mm-hmm. conflict. So by saying that it is not a religious conflict, it's almost as if we cut ourselves off from discussing the religious aspects of it.
Oh, I think that's a very helpful observation. And it's not the case that people who have a faith system that helps them order their lives separate out that faith system when they're making important judgments about anything. And I think functionally in the United States, we've been used to a legal separation between church and state. But that doesn't mean that you cease to be a religious person in the United States when you're participating in the public sphere. You're still the same person. And so it's really an artificial distinction. I think what is more pernicious is to cast the conflicts that we're in, for example, in relationship to Afghanistan and Iraq, and where we have encountered terrorism, this has been cast as a clash of civilizations. And so it's a kind of modernism versus pre-modernist view. And I think you can make a better case for the fact that this is really a clash of fundamentalisms, that you have one fundamentalist perspective guiding this administration and other fundamentalist perspectives guiding those who would oppose this administration. So I think we're that's miscast, and it's arrogant that it's the civilized world against the uncivilized. I think it's unhelpful.
This is something that I think kind of scares a lot of people, because, you know, while we say we have separation of church and state, and we are, and, you know, there's this debate of whether, you know, America was founded on Christian ideals mm-hmm. or whether it was founded on multi-faith, you know, acceptance, tolerance of any faith. There does seem to be this undercurrent that occasionally surfaces in a very explicit way, as you observe in one piece you wrote for the Chicago Tribune, the example of Lieutenant General William Boykin, who, you know, was, I think still is, engaged mm-hmm. in policymaking with regard to the war in Iraq, and who was giving essentially sermons in churches about how this was a clash of religions, mm-hmm. of essentially between Christianity and Islam.
Yes. General Boykin was wearing his uniform while he was giving these talks and saying that when he fought warlords in Somalia, that he knew that his God, the Christian God, was more powerful than the Muslim God, who was an idol. And I quoted the Quran in there because, of course, in the Quran, it says that we worship the same God as the Christians and the Jews. And I was on a call-in talk show about that editorial for NPR. And people say, well, their God has a different name, Allah. And, of course, that is the Arabic word for God. It's just not another name, Mr. Allah. It's just the word. And there's an awful lot of basic and simple misunderstanding that contributes to these kinds of conflicts. But I think that it's unfortunately not atypical. There are some very frightening ways in which people on the religious right are trying to exploit aspects of world conflict to see Islam as the enemy. Hal Lindsey has written a book called The Everlasting Hatred, Islam.
As someone who has studied the Christian traditions, as you enumerated a few of these concepts to start with, I guess the question is, how do you go about then, you know, resolving these conflicts? How do you go about, you know, establishing a dialogue both with the people that have essentially targeted, the United States, or have chosen violent tactics as a means of expressing their aims or rage? How do you go about engaging? How do you even begin a dialogue?
Mm-hmm. Well, that gets us directly into what is cooperative conflict resolution. And there are a number of perspectival changes that I think you need to bring to understand how this works. The first would be you do have to try to understand the other's point of view. I gave a talk on this last week, and terrorists do not just jump up out of the ground like those monsters in Lord of the Rings 3 that are created out of dirt. They come from someplace. There's some reason why they are doing what they're doing. This may not be apparent to you, but terrorists are not an aberration in history. They have a motivation, and you've got to try to, as hard as it can be, you've got to try to understand what that motivation is. Secondly, you need to listen. You've got to shut up and pay attention to what other people are saying. Again, not sometimes. I think Americans are peculiarly allergic to trying to understand where terrorists are coming from, with some confusion that understanding equals sympathy. The reverse is true. If you don't understand the context out of which people are coming, and if you don't listen to what they're really saying, you have absolutely no hope of understanding how to resolve the conflict. You can't demonize the other. And as I said, I think you notice in each of these steps, currently the people guiding our foreign policy manage to violate each one of these tenets with some regularity. If you demonize or dehumanize the other, then you make the possibility of dialogue even that more remote. You've also got to confess that you have some part and some accountability for situations in conflict. I have said in various settings, we trained Osama bin Laden. He was our guy. We have some history, some accountability. Saddam Hussein, our guy. When we say that we're looking for biological and chemical weapons in Iraq, we know he had them because we sold them to him. He just used them on his own people. There's a historical amnesia where we don't understand that some of the situations in which people find themselves in debilitated areas around the world, we don't have all the responsibility, but we do have some. And that kind of historical amnesia contributes to people failing to be able to do cooperative conflict resolution. And in Christian terms, you've got to confess. You've got to acknowledge and confess. You need to be honest and transparent. Whereas diplomacy is often done through the back door, cooperative conflict resolution is done through the front door. It's available, public, open, no secrets. You've got to have an understanding of shared power and an ability to let go of some control in order to achieve a new resolution. Resolution is not going to be your side or my side. It's going to be something yet that we have not invented. Finally, there is a use of force in cooperative conflict resolution. Force is used to separate, to create safe zones, to create accompaniment, to get warring parties apart, to simply stop the killing. It's not a proactive use of force in the sense that we achieve our goals through force, but sometimes you do need to employ peacekeeping forces who are trained in the methods of cooperative conflict resolution in order to be able to get people to stop killing each other long enough to try to the other steps take place. It's a risky business. You know, think about peacemakers around Gandhi was assassinated, Sadat was assassinated. King was assassinated. It's a risky job to be a peacemaker. But as Yitzhak Rabin, somebody else who was assassinated, said, you don't make peace with your friends. You make peace with your enemies. It's a different point of view. You got to have a long-term perspective. Long-lasting peace is not just add water and stir. It takes an awful lot of effort over a long period of time, and you have to have a long-term view. You also have to have a view towards prevention. What can we do to prevent conflict? What kinds of things tend over the long haul to prevent conflict? Two simplest are participatory economic systems and participatory political systems. Those are better descriptions, I think, simply than democracy or ism, because these kinds of systems can promote democracy, can promote participation, or sometimes it is a gloss for a lack of participation. So I think it's better to say when people participate in their society, when they have a decent standard of living, when they feel they have some control over the political power processes, they don't become terrorists. It's obvious. And finally, you've got to intend both to peace and justice. Just the absence of violence does not necessarily mean you have justice. And just the presence of justice doesn't always mean that you don't have conflict. So peace and justice have to go hand in hand. And those are the descriptions of cooperative conflict resolution that you need to use to guide you through these kinds of negotiations.
We're talking this morning with Susan Thistlethwaite. She's president of the Chicago Theological Seminary, and we're talking with her this morning about Christian conflict resolution and a variety of issues that touches upon in the world today. As you were going down that list there, I was thinking, boy, that's there are a lot of things we have to stop doing in order to even start doing some of those things. And in particular, we could just even go down the list. The idea of not demonizing the opposition. We have this axis of evil. Mm-hmm. We had the evil empire. We have evil is a word that we seem to apply to people who want to do us harm, who have, Osama bin Laden. It's easy to describe him or to feel that he is an evil person. On the other hand, that sort of paints one into a corner in certain ways, it seems to be what you're saying.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think you've really put your finger on one of the key theological issues in relationship to the kinds of theologies that fund demonizing the other and the kinds of theologies that tend to promote cooperative conflict resolution. When you see the world into the good, divided into the good, namely us, and everybody else is evil, it makes it extremely difficult then to become self-aware, self-critical of your own actions. And you can't find anything in the other. If you dismiss the other as completely evil, it becomes very difficult to listen to what they're really saying. I mean, take something that is egregious. Take what just happened in the school in Russia. And you can easily apply the word evil to people who would come in and treat those children as and their parents and their teachers as they did, wire the school with bombs, shoot children in the back, and all the rest of it. And it makes it extraordinarily difficult to be able to try to separate out what is happening between Russia and Chechnya. And any place around the world where the poor folks have oil, you're going to be toast. They're also Muslims. For secular by government policy, Russia, that's also anathema. And Russian leader after Russian leader has just massacred these people over and over and over again. They are nationalists, they are separatists, and they can't get a hearing. They turn to terrorism. Then you have outsiders come in. You have now an involvement apparently of a warlord. People get desperate and they turn to terrorists in order to help them, quote unquote. You get perhaps more help than you bargained for because you get cynical political architects of terrorism who are not perhaps motivated by the same kind of desperation as the people on the ground, who are usually, therefore, the terrorists who also get killed. And so it's a multi-layered problem. But, you know, the reports, fragmented as they are, of what motivated people to do something so totally heinous as to kill children was they wanted to do something so heinous that they could precipitate a war. And a good way to do that is to do something so horrible that you cut off the other side's willingness to even think about alternatives. And they've been shrewd, terrorists. They've been very shrewd. I think all Americans are still suffering, or many Americans are still suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder about 9/11. Mm-hmm. We don't want to think about what motivated people to do that. And so it's very effective right from the beginning of shutting down the possibility of seeing things from the other perspective.
Well, added to that is the notion that if we even begin to consider this other viewpoint, we are in some way caving into those people and showing weakness. And I think especially Americans, we have this machismo that showing weakness is the worst thing you can possibly do. So the only way you can – the only course of action is war, essentially, to fight and win. But maybe we don't even know what that means.
Yes. And yet, you know, as I went down with you the litany of people who have died for peacemaking, it takes a tougher person to make peace. Violence, said King, is the ultimate weakness.
We have a call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. And we're about at our midpoint, so let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Susan Thistlethwaite. She's president of the Chicago Theological Seminary. We have someone in Urbana on line number one.
Good morning. I tuned in late, so I may be asking something that's already been covered. And I'm sorry I turned in late because this is a fascinating discussion. I think I totally understand when you talk about demonization and then that makes it impossible to negotiate because the other side is a demon.
Mm-hmm.
Since 9/11 is just too close to us to discuss, perhaps I can ask my question vis-a-vis what is going on between Russia and Chechnya.
Mm-hmm.
The worst has happened. They people came in, whoever they are, who wanted to have a war, and one way to do it was, you know, to shoot little children in the back, as you described it.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are at this impasse. And what now would both sides have to do? I can understand how one might avoid, you know, such a horrific situation.
Mm.
But the horrific situation is now there.
Right.
And it, you know, it looks like there's going to be ongoing war between the Muslim states and Russia. What can be done using your approach?
Well, this would first we'd have to convince Vladimir Putin change course. You know, the reaction of Putin has been very much exactly as Jack was just saying, to become even more aggressive, tough guy. And remember, he ran on a platform, I'm going to get tough about
right.
Chechnya. And you can see how well that's worked in terms of reducing terrorism. So I think that's a big hurdle because he is, after all, KGB trained, and they are notoriously not people particularly good at seeing things from other people's point of view.
Right.
But, you know, the worst problem in the relationship between, unlike other provinces that have wanted to have a more autonomy relative to Russia, because of the oil in Chechnya, the Russians are singularly unwilling to let them have even the same degree of autonomy that they have allotted to other such provinces.
Oh, it's that oil again.
It's oil, yes. And you know, you're not hearing that enough
in
what we hear
it.
In the West. But next to Saudi Arabia, the Chechens are sitting on the second largest oil fields in the world. And so, you know, it's blood and oil, and you've got to keep both of those two things in view. One of the things that would be helpful, and I think that's where the whole transparency issue comes in, that would need to be more apparent to people why the Russians will not let these people go, will not let them have any autonomy. And that kind of, you know, listen to your own voice. Listen to the insight that you yourself are achieving just by knowing it's oil again. And, you know, I think where are we in the West going to acknowledge part of our responsibility? We're addicted to oil. It's like heroin to our societies. And so... those are some steps. They may be modest, but I think you can see in your own reaction how that degree of insight helps you understand why the Russians feel they need to demonize the Chechens, and the Chechens in turn are tired of mass graves in their country. They want autonomy. And these two things are intractable because you've got the oil.
Maybe we should, if it's okay with you, bring it closer to home in with happening in Afghanistan and Iraq. And with this administration, it is hopeless to do anything to lessen the demonization of the Afghan country and the original old leadership of Iraq. And so, again, this administration has totally demonized the other.
Yes, I agree with you. But one of the best things about cooperative conflict resolution is nothing is hopeless. And the government is also us. It's you and me. And it's our capacity to... question, to name things, to ask, and to vote, to be able to want more transparency, to be able to...
Transparency in government.
Yes, transparency in government. And also to challenge fear-mongering. Someone asked me what I thought the worst problem was we face today in the United States, and I think it is the fear-mongering. And from a Christian theological perspective, that is really the ultimate unfaithfulness, because you are then not trusting God. So I think that even in our situation, there are ways in which you can, through grassroots citizen action, be the change you want to see. You don't have to accept this from your leaders. You can make a change.
You just used a phrase which I had not heard before, and it's, I'm sorry, I'm a senior citizen and these things come and go.
You know, I'm getting that way more myself, and I am highly sympathetic. So,
is it be the change you want to see? That's a nice phrase.
Yes, that is a nice phrase.
I didn't invent it. That's Gandhi.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. Our lines are all full. I have lots of questions, but I always defer to the caller. So,
certainly.
We'll go next to someone on a cell phone on line number two. Good morning.
Hi there.
Yes.
First of all, I'd like to say God bless you for what you're working toward here. That certainly is a time in our history when we need voices such as yours. And as a person of faith, as a person who's committed to interfaith dialogue, as a person who in principle believes in peace and justice, and who prays for peace, I know in my heart, in my best moments, that that what you're talking about in principle is also very practical, and yet, like many other people, particularly in this country these days, I just can't help but feeling that there is also evil in the world. We certainly can't demonize a whole religion or a whole ethnic group or something like that because of the actions of a few. But certainly people like bin Laden and al-Zawahiri and people like that need to be dealt with. There's no negotiation with some of these folks as much as we would like to. And I guess I'm struggling with how do we go as a nation go about trying to get at the root causes of some of these problems, mm-hmm. work with people who would be willing to do that. And I understand the quote earlier, too, about, you know, you don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies. And yet, we shouldn't have this misdirected stuff, this adventure in Iraq and all of that. But certainly some of these people just, I know that this is not, you know, what Jesus would teach, and as a Christian I shouldn't say it, but some of these folks are just taking up somebody else's air, as far as I'm concerned. And surely someone who kills hundreds or thousands of people or innocent children like we saw, the people that were behind that, mm-hmm. whatever their motivation, how can we, I'll hang up and listen, but how would you suggest that we deal with that? I mean, surely there is some accountability in this life for one's actions. And I'll hang up and listen.
Sure.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I think you raised a very profound question, because when Jesus says, love your enemies and bless those who persecute you, I will tell you I find that the most challenging aspect of Christianity. And I am nobody's idea of a saint. I mean, ask anybody at Chicago Theological Seminary, and they will tell you. And so I think that that is a challenge of faithfulness. However, I want to also offer to you that cooperative conflict resolution is a very practical way to not make more enemies. And it is more helpful, as we think about the situation we're in, to think of bin Laden as a criminal thug and somebody we need to find and arrest. And I would like to actually know why we're not paying attention to bin Laden anymore, possibly because this administration is distracted by their preemptive war in Iraq. But I think you find and you arrest a criminal and you put them in jails. I have no evidence who is behind the Iraqi insurgency, but they're so darn good at it. It certainly bears the mark of bin Laden. There is the need to confess. We trained this guy. And there's just no acknowledgement of that. And so when you draw on sweeping cosmic good versus evil categories, you dehistoricize things, make it impossible to see that these are people who come out of a certain context and out of a certain history, which we helped create. You make it impossible to deal with him practically. We just have, you know, criminals need to be arrested and jailed. And I think that demonization on a practical level is, it just doesn't work as well as trying to see people as simply historical actors. And these are forces that we need to engage and try to change what is giving rise to these behaviors. And there's a very fine book, Why Religious Militants Kill, by Jessica Stern, Harvard. She interviewed religious terrorists for 4 years. And alienation, despair, and impotence over and over and over again give rise to the people who are, in fact, the cannon fodder, the terrorists who carry out these activities. And they are mobilized by people who are, I think, more the architects or the criminal thugs. But on a very practical level, and it's one of the things that we try to argue in our Just Peacemaking book, is that Just Peacemaking works. It actually works on a practical level. And big sweeping statements about good and evil and demonizing everybody just end up getting a whole lot more people killed and perpetuating the spiral of violence. If we don't change this, we are moving towards this country being permanently at war.
I have a couple calls I promise we'll get right to, but as a quick follow-up, I was thinking from what the previous caller was saying, in light of events in Iraq, we see time and time again situations where there are insurgents in Iraq who are attacking both the infrastructure, the Iraqi government, and the Americans. And in response, we are, taking military action against these people in ways that that kill a lot of innocent people. Mm-hmm. And we know that this we say to ourselves, this is the cost. This is part of the collateral damage. It's something that is inevitable in warfare. We see ourselves as good. We don't see ourselves as evil. Mm-hmm. And yet, I saw a news article the other day again, in the middle of, one of the towns in Baghdad, there were insurgents who were firing on American forces. American forces fired back and innocent people died again. Mm-hmm. And this plays out over and over. And one has to think about what's the cost of this?
Yes.
When innocent people see other people, innocent people being killed by American forces or the Iraqi forces, they don't think we're so good.
Right. And I think that lifts up, Jack, a very, very critical point. And that is that this kind of good-evil divide, we're good, the other side is evil, leads you into incredibly naive views of the world. I really think that the people who conducted the preemptive war in Iraq, President Bush, Rumsfeld, and so forth, I don't think they're cynical people. I think they actually believed we would be greeted as liberators. I think they believed that people would be throwing flowers at the tanks and grateful to the United States, and do not have a worldview that gives them the capacity for the kind of self-critical and nuanced analysis of their actions, nor of the ability to really pay attention to the attitudes of others. People's motivations are very mixed, both one's own and the motivations of people who oppose you. I was having a conversation with an Afghan man earlier this week, and he had recently been in Afghanistan, and he was talking about the difference between our presence in Afghanistan and the Germans and the French. And given the thoroughness of the news reporting in the United States and a CNN and Fox level, you're not even aware, of course, that the French and the Germans are there. And what they're doing, they're building schools, they're building roads, they're building hospitals. And he said, and the Americans ride around in Humvees and shoot at people. There's one exception to this. In Kabul, there's a school being built, the Laura Bush School. And this is making the Afghans furious that this Afghan school for girls has Laura Bush's name on it. So even when we build a school, we're making people angry at us. But our presence in Afghanistan as a military presence, and one that is characterized by that kind of activity, contrasts fairly sharply with the people who are just going about building schools, building roads, and bringing back the kind of infrastructure. I mean, these people were bombed back into the 8th and 9th century, and they've also got, not even recovered from the Russian, the war with Russia. So, we're not a benign presence, but the good and evil divide convinces us, since, you've got not a lot of room to maneuver if you're the good, then everything you do must be good. So you can't see the consequences of your own actions.
We have a couple callers. Let's include them. We'll go next to someone in Belgium. I believe that's Belgium, Illinois, not in Europe, on line number 4. Good morning.
Yes, it is. First, I'd like to state that Mr. Inge and Mr. Brighton and the WILL philosophy at least allows us to have this conversation, which many other organizations don't even allow because they won't even bring it up. They got to scream this right-wing malarkey to the top of the rafters. I would like to point out in my own statement on this or question is that it is so difficult for us to get over the cultural differences between us and other portions of the world. And it's not just Islamic. It's much deeper than that. And it's gone on for a millennia. And we've caused pain there that has gone on for, like I said, a millennia. And we're not able to understand the cultural differences between ourselves and, quote-unquote, the terrorists. These people are fighting a war for their own rights. They want to better their own lives, and we refuse to see this. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you. And one of the reasons I titled my address today that at the Y that you can look at cultural differences as a threat, or you can look at them as a resource. You can look at the way other people, not that you're going to always merge with them or become the same, but you can find that threatening, or you can find it, oh, good, more. It's a different point of view, and Americans have tended to see cultural differences as threat. I think it's the part of the legacy of slavery and other things that shape this country, our treatment of Native Americans, that we see the otherness as threatening. And I think that hurts us as a people.
Which is really odd because we're a nation that was built on people from all the rest of the world.
Absolutely.
So, there's more we could talk about there, but we have another caller waiting patiently on line number 3, someone in Urbana. Good morning.
Hello. I thought you did a very good job of covering the Chechnya problems, but did you point out that the incident which provoked the reoccupation of Chechnya was bombings of apartment houses in Moscow? Almost certainly those bombings were not done by the Chechens, but by the Russian secret police. That's pretty well confirmed. I guess the other comment I'd like to make is that as I grow older, I increasingly become a Blakean. I think, yes, there's evil out there, but it exists along with good in each of us. Mm. And when we lose sight of that, we do terrible things.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think the first thing you do need to do is look to your own soul and the examination of conscience. I do not know this investigation into whether or not the Russian secret police bombed those apartment houses. It does, whether it is documented or not, show how convoluted some of this terror and counterterror can become, where people do, and I'm speaking now in a general sense since I don't know the specifics, but where people do, in fact, perpetrate incidents, blame it on the other side, and then say, look what you did, and this becomes a pretext for then violence against them. And so I don't know that in the specific sense, but in a general sense, it fits the logic of the spiral of violence that terrorism gets us into.
Well, it was reported in the Manchester Guardian that this was probable. There's obviously no documentation.
Right, exactly.
The other possible theory would be criminal elements, but almost certainly it was not Chechens, because the Chechens had not been guilty of this kind of act, and they had limited, at least, independence. And the last thing in the world they wanted was to provoke the Russians into coming back into Chechnya. There's comment about the horrendous killing of women and children, but how many hundreds and thousands of women and children have the Russians killed in Chechnya? And we don't seem to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Or even our killing of women and children in Iraq. I'm afraid I've become a pacifist because I think war only results in more problems. Well, thank you.
Well, I would just say don't be afraid of becoming a pacifist. I think that's a wonderful thing.
We have just about maybe a little less than five minutes left, actually, and one caller I want to make sure we include before we run out of time. Someone in Bloomington, Indiana, on line number 4. Good morning.
Hi. The guest implied that some of the European participants in Afghanistan are doing wonderful work, and I'm sure they are, but she implied that the Americans are not. Well, I think this guest will remember before the war in Afghanistan, two young ladies by the name of Curry and Mercer. They were Christian missionaries. Do you remember those young ladies? And they were, by the way, Taliban, the Muslims captured them while they were doing missionary work, accused them of proselytizing, and they were going to kill these girls. They had sentenced them to death. Now, I know that there are some wonderful Christian missionaries that are from America in Afghanistan right now because my sister is one of them. And I know they're doing wonderful work, and the people love them. My sister tells me about it, tells about some of the wonderful people she's met. And to say that the American military is all bad and is simply aggravating hostility, if it were not for the American military, none of that good social work could be done. Remember that Miss Curry and Miss Mercer were threatened with death for the good work they were doing. Now those missionaries can work and do all those good works. The Europeans can do all the good work that they're doing because the American military are protecting them, are making it possible, madam.
Thank you for your passion there. I was quoting a young Afghan man, and I think we should make a separation between people who are doing Christian missionary work and official American military activity. I think that these are complicated situations, and one person's point of view cannot illuminate it all. I'm sure you're also very, very worried about these family members who are there, and not without cause. Remember also, though, that this is another situation in which we are not particularly innocent as a country. You have a long war that was between the Afghanistanis and the Russians that precipitated a vacuum, a political vacuum. And was there an American Marshall Plan for the Afghans when the Russians pulled out? No. We allowed this country to simply devolve into chaos out of which the Taliban emerged.
Yeah, but you know, yeah. Miss Curry and Miss Mercer were taking up the slack. They didn't have government support.
Mm-hmm.
But they were doing some missionary work and they're trying to help those people.
Good, and I'm glad to hear about it. Thank you.
Okay. Does that get your question? Well, I happen to know enough from the caller's previous calls that he is someone who cares deeply about these issues, and I thank him for making that point. I'm also mindful that when people feel strongly about things, for example, I heard him say something, the Muslims had threatened to kidnap these people, and I'm afraid that we tend to use these definitions. Mm-hmm. To say, the Muslims or the Americans, and we're not all the same. No one, no group of people is unified and, can be defined by one word, it seems. And maybe that's part of our problem.
Well, it fits, in an overarching sense with what I'm trying to say is be specific, be concrete, don't globalize, don't demonize. Don't make these kind of cosmic differences. Everybody over on this side is good. Everybody over on that side is bad. Look at who is building schools. Look at who is building roads. Look at you know, people who are doing Christianly motivated missionary activity, and be specific, because the more you fall into generalizations and kind of universal projections onto other people, the fewer options you leave yourself in being able to do cooperative conflict resolution.
We'll have to leave it there since we're out of time. And Susan Thistle-Thwaite is her name. She's president of the Chicago Theological Seminary. And thank you so much for being here.
You're so welcome.
And again, that was an archive from September 17th, 2004, a show that we wanted to rebroadcast because we thought it had relevance for continuing situations today. Hope you enjoyed that archive, and we will carry on. And with tomorrow, just to let you know, during the first hour of Focus 580, Sandy Mason will be here. She's a horticultural educator with the Champaign County Cooperative Extension Service, and take your questions about growing things around the house and garden. Then 11 o'clock tomorrow, we'll talk with David Remnick. He is the editor of The New Yorker magazine, author of the book Reporting, Writings from The New Yorker. We'll talk about a variety of things with regard to reporting and the media tomorrow morning at 11.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet. Christie Clinic, medicine for your life.
That's it for this hour of Focus 580, actually Focus 580 for the day. Time to hand things off to Todd Gleason, host of today's afternoon magazine.
And thanks much. We appreciate it, Jack. Jack Brighton, of course, hosting the Focus 580 program this morning. And thanks much to him for filling in for David, and we appreciate all the work he's done. Taking a look now at what's been happening in Chicago at the Board of Trade. At this hour, grain futures continuing to trade a bit lower. That on some spillover weakness from the outside markets. There was a sharp sell-off in both the metals and the energies that combined with the high U.S. dollar index, and that sparked a round of non-commercial selling today in the grains, led down by the soybeans. The corn market continues to home firm following Friday's impressive rally there. Taking a quick look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade, futures in the wheat pit are off a nickel today at 396.5. The September's at 408.5 are down a nickel at 396.5. Of course, the July contract for the soft red winter wheat in Chicago, July wheat in Kansas City.